A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Ram, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on February 20, 2000, in the series The God Question, entitled The Question That Will Not Go Away. The texts for the sermon are Job 23, verses 1 through 10, Psalm 42, and John 3, verses 1 through 10. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Well, I not only brought a cold home, but while I was away, I celebrated my 65th birthday. And I am so happy that I didn't decide to retire because I haven't settled the God question yet. And if I didn't have you to torment every Saturday, Sunday morning, I just might let it slip before I had it all solved. The God question, the question that will not go away. The question that I think is deeply written in the fabric of our being, being human as we are. That deep yearning, that sometimes unconscious longing, that struggle, that wrestling, that wondering, for a couple of weeks, let's think about God, the God question, the question that will not go away. Let's have a conversation about God. Now, that's the problem, of course. You're seeking God, and I want to have a conversation about God. On the one hand, you're seeking experience, and I want to engage you in a thinking exercise, an intellectual endeavor. And that's always the problem, isn't it? I've been acutely aware of that for a long, long time, trying to point people to God in order that there might be the experience of God, but doing it in a way which defies the possibility of experience, because God will not be experienced at the end of our rational endeavors, our reasoning. God is not at the end of a syllogism, our finest thought projects do not bring us to the experience of God. But I can do no better than that, no better than having a conversation with you about God, hoping that in our conversation about God there might yet be some experience of the living God. And I do think that there is a place for thoughtful conversation about God, because our spiritual experience now and again brings with it a longing to understand, the desire to have some illumination of the meaning of that experience. So today and for a couple of weeks, let's think about the God question, that deep yearning within, whether we're always conscious of it or not, to have an experience of that mystery of life that is beyond our comprehension, that mystery of our existence, the God question. In doing so, we are doing what has been so very common to humankind. I'm not so naive as to think that you got up this morning and said, thank God it's Sunday. I shall arise and go to worship and have some experience of God. And yet, on the other hand, why are you here? Why are we gathered here? Why do we come week after week in such a setting as this, with such a focus as this, if not because, whether consciously or unconsciously, There is a hole within our souls that we seek to fill. There is a question put to our existence. There is a wondering about the meaning of it all. Whether it makes any difference, whether this is all there is, whether there isn't something more, and what the meaning of all of our cumulative experience can finally add up to. And so, in gathering as we do, in thinking for a bit on the God question, we're doing what has been endemic to our human experience and certainly a part of our biblical experience. Sometimes it comes in situations of great extremity, such as Job went through. Job defying the conventional wisdom of his day, refusing to say that because he was suffering, he therefore had sinned. Refusing the common theological cliches of his own day, he railed against his miserable comforters. And then in the midst of his deep distress, cried out with such pathos, "Oh, that I knew where I might find him. I go to the right hand, God is not there, and to the left, and I cannot perceive God. Oh, that I could come into his dwelling place and make my case and get some answer to the anguish of my human existence." And the psalmist, in some situation of exile and alienation, wrote also movingly of the heart that longs for living streams. And he said, "So, O God, my soul thirsts, hungers for you." And he remembers times past, times of rich experience. And now in the barrenness and the alienation, he can only remember and experience his soul cast down. "My soul thirsts for the living God." And it doesn't always happen in times of extremity or distress, but it can be just the cumulative questions that come as a consequence of living, or the appearance of some person or some new idea that triggers a Nicodemus to go to Jesus to say, "I know you're a prophet from God. What's this all about?" To which Jesus says, "You must be born again." Ah, those words of late trip off everybody's tongue. But John, in his typical style, uses a word that can be translated either born again or born from above. But what Jesus was saying is there's something more to this than just a simple human quest for some empirical verification of the data of our lives. This is the stuff of spiritual illumination. This is the stuff of gift, of grace. And so we stand in the biblical tradition of those who have long hungered after God and sought after God. The psalm is a poem and Job is a drama, no historical thing. It's a drama because the search for God and the language with which we do the search is the language of poetry and of theater, because it's the deep stuff of being human, that longing for a touch of grace, the brush of an angel's wing. So let us begin to think about God. And what an interesting time it is to be thinking about God. As I was thinking about coming back to have a conversation with you about God, of course, I was reading wildly and widely. Just before I left, I opened my copy of The Economist, which is a British news magazine, an excellent world news magazine, whose last page, before all of the advertisements and so on, is always a column entitled in simple black, The Obituary. And the obituary picks up some significant person who has died in the last week or 10 days. Of course, it's a highly selective thing. How do you get in The Economist's obituary column? Well, you have to die first, of course. Other than that, they can hardly cover the whole world of significant people. But this was December 31, 1999, the last issue, the millennial issue, the last issue of the 20th century. And the obituary column had boldly written here, God. The obituary of God. And it begins, when your friends start looking for proofs of your existence, you're heading for trouble. That was God's situation as the millennium got into its stride. And it's very cleverly written. Interesting. A survey of the whole modern situation, the whole modern struggle with God. Some artist's rendering of God, I suppose that's God. Not terribly attractive. But I think The Economist editors knew that they were doing this a bit tongue-in-cheek. Because while it's the obituary of God, under the portrait of God, I read, after a lengthy career, the Almighty recently passed into history. Or did he? And they go on, eventually coming to Nietzsche at the beginning of the 20th century, who announced God is dead. And then saying, but somehow or other the Superman never arrived. And then saying that the people never did believe it. The corpse just wouldn't lie down. He popped up in the oddest places. The editors indicating the fact that with the God question, you're never through. The question keeps popping up. Could never put God to bed, so to speak. One of the books I read recently, also published in 1999, was A.N. Wilson, the wonderful British author who wrote the book God's Funeral. If you want a wonderful read, God's Funeral. 19th century thinkers, politicians, theologians, sociologists, poets, the 19th century confronted with the explosion of modern knowledge that was like acid to the old theological structures of the faith and to the forms of the institution. God's Funeral. It's the title of Thomas Hardy's poem with which the book opens. A wonderful, moving poem in which Thomas Hardy pictures a funeral procession off on the horizon, a growing procession of people bearing a corpse, bearing the corpse of the God that they had imagined and in whom they had believed, but in whom they could believe no longer. God's funeral. God died. With the onslaught of modern knowledge and fresh understanding. And there's no triumphalism or celebration in the poem. Thomas Hardy writes with a heavy heart, with a great sense of loss, a deep grief, because the very center of life, as it were, had been sucked out. God's funeral. And then, knowing I was going to come back and have this conversation with you, I took along with me Winifred Gallagher's Working on God, also recently published. Winifred Gallagher, a 60s kid, like some of you. I was older, of course. In 1960, I was ordained in this congregation, but the 60s, well, you know what the 60s were. And Winifred Gallagher was one of those suave, sophisticated, educated, with it, young Americans who threw it all off, raised in a nominal Catholic Christian home. But having gotten caught up in all of the secularity of life, speaking of herself as a super achiever, as a super consumer, as a rugged individualist driven by blind ambition and acquisition and success, and doing very well, thank you, but running on empty. And so she began to look around and found a lot of her peers likewise caught up in the drivenness of life, succeeding very well, and being hollow people. So she began her own spiritual pilgrimage. She immersed herself again in the Christian tradition from which she stemmed, in the Jewish tradition, which was her second husband's tradition, and into Buddhism, to which she was terribly attracted. And she went in depth, got herself all deeply involved in not only study, but practice of these respective traditions. And she chronicles the story in the book Working on God very, very interestingly, and comes to the conclusion that she is one of a multitude of people today whom she denominates neo-agnostics. Neo-agnostics. They are the ones who have thrown it all over, who have not been involved and engaged at all in the spiritual pursuit, have not wrestled with God, have been on their way in all of the fascination of modern culture, learning, sophistication, but who've come up hungry, for whom the God question will not down. And Winifred Gallagher suggests that there is hunger and thirst all over the landscape of those who are once again saying, what is real? And what do I feel? And what choices do I have? It's a fascinating read, which tells me that there are multitudes out there, as Gallagher says, who will not return to the institutional church or its dogmatic proclamations or its moral absolutisms, but who, in leaving the institution and the dogmatism and the moralism, are discovering that they have also left something that is so intrinsic to our human being, that is a spiritual core, the experience of God. I am amazed as I reflect on the contrast between the cultural situation today and when I came into the ministry and was ordained here 40 years ago, one of the privileges they tell me of reaching 65 is you can recollect. So get prepared for a lot of that. When I came in the early 60s, I was very defensive. I was afraid for the faith. I felt I had to defend God. I had a neat little system, and I could argue it logically. And it was the time of the cultural upheaval. And I remember, I think it was 1967 in the spring, Time magazine twice a year gives a little bow to God, usually Holy Week and Christmas or something on the cover. And I remember the black cover of Time magazine in red letters, "Is God Dead?" And I remember that great discussion that roared in the mid-60s about the death of God theologians. And one of the persons that reflected on that theologically was Harvey Cox. Harvey Cox, a Harvard professor who will be in Muskegon in April. Harvey Cox wrote a book that was a runaway bestseller, The Secular City, in which Harvey Cox celebrated the secular city as a place that had come into its own, come to maturity, and as a theologian was trying to say, how do you find the signs of grace? How do you experience God in the totally secular environment of modern life? He was responding to the death of God theologians. As he says in his latest book, "I was young, I was impressionable, I took them too seriously, as though God was dead." But he was reflecting what was in the cultural air. His latest book, which I just completed, Fire from Heaven, which is the chronicle of his global exploration of the phenomenon of Pentecostalism. And he goes around the globe and shows in the Asian Rim and Russia and Europe and across this country this massive renewal of spirit. It's the kind of expression of Christian faith that I can well do without, thank you very much. And I think Harvey Cox would probably say the same thing, except that he says, as he actually, again, immersed himself in it, in all of these respective contexts, that there is something alive, there's something vital. There are people who are giving expression to something that is deeply human. Throwing off again the old institutional forms of the church and not terribly interested about theology per se, but hungering for experience. And so they sing and they shout and they dance and they express a living vitality which Cox suggests is probably the consequence of the fact that the human animal finally vibrates with spirit and responds with spirit and yearns for and hungers for spirit, however, whatever form that may take. And so Harvey Cox does full cycle from the secular city to fire from heaven. And if I needed one more sign that I was onto something, when I returned home, there was a package from Albert Knopf Publishers, Random House. And it was a complimentary copy from Karen Armstrong of her recent book, just being published, not on the shelves yet, I think. Its title, The Battle for God, a study of Christian, Jewish, and Islamic fundamentalism, which is the rebellion of masses of our culture against modernity, against modern knowledge, the attempt, futilely I think, to go back, but indicating nonetheless this human hunger for God that will not quit. The question that will not go away. The God question. And so, I am so delighted to be here at this time. I find it so stimulating, so fascinating. I think of the contrast with which I considered the God trust question 40 years ago, afraid, rigid, having all the answers and not understanding the questions, fearful that I couldn't defend God, not understanding that it was simply my little caricature of God, not understanding that God is a mystery beyond our comprehension, the ground, the inexhaustible ground and source of all life. Dear God, I don't know how they dare let young people out, turn them loose on the church when I think back. Some of you were here, you put up with a lot. But what a contrast with this present moment in which we deal not with the God answer, but with the God question, where with openness and freedom and with joy and fascination, we can think together, live together into the God question, recognizing that there is no corner on the truth hidden somewhere that we can finally discover, but realizing that it's the stuff of poets and novels and the theater, interwoven with the biblical story that simply narrates and chronicles the human quest for the God who has come to us, who embraces us, who is the very air that we breathe. What a wonderful moment to be alive. What a wonderful community of which to be a part. What joy and freedom to search the God question and to know that we are dealing with that ultimate reality, that spiritual truth at the center of things, whose expressions are multiform, whose ways are many. The God whom one will have to find in one's own way. For while we do it in community, there's not a party line, there's not a final paradigm. What a wonderful day in which to be alive. Maybe I'm celebrating my own freedom as I reflect back on that crimped and crabbed and fearful place from which I came to this time of wonderful, free, relaxed reveling in the reality that is the God who is always beyond our finest expression. So, welcome to the journey. What a good question. What a good place to be. And I suspect that's really why we've stuck together and continue on our way together. And who knows, here and there. But there might be a fresh brush of grace.